Velvet Podcast. Literature, genre fiction,
horror, sci-fi, neo-noir, speculative,
writing, films, music, and probably a few dick jokes. And now, recorded via the magic of the internet, please welcome this episode's hosts.
Welcome to the very first episode of the Velvet Podcast. I am Caleb. My username over there at the Velvet is Thirsty Gerbil. And up to my north here, we've got Rob Parker. Rob, how are you?
Hey, hi. I'm doing well.
Good, good, good. Mutter some taxi cab, I guess, would be the nomer we'd like to give you. Anything going on in your life? What's going on?
Yeah, I guess, you know, a quick bit of background, like as to why I, you know, anybody should listen to what the hell I have to say. And believe me, you probably shouldn't. Yeah, there's only two events in my life that got me into the books. One was video games. I was about five or six. My parents had like this ancient ass dinosaur of a computer. And there was this little castle game where you're running around. And I was the only kid in my kindergarten class that knew how to spell scepter. That's how I got into learning to read and write, and then they just echoed that at school. And then that kind of got me into video games, and through those, in a roundabout way, I found Neuromancer by William Gibson, and then I kind of fell into a whole bunch of other stuff. And then the first time I started writing was through music, actually. A Canadian rock star dude by the name of Matthew Good started posting short stories. And so, yeah, most of my stuff, whenever I'm writing, is usually coming from either misheard lyrics or some weird, like, vaguely tangentially associated, like, deformation of some song that I'm listening to. And I listen to a lot of music. I think I have some music probably running in the background, just muted, just so I can watch it going across the screen, knowing that music is happening somewhere nearby. So
I've heard that other than an iPod, you actually carry a hard drive around with you full of nothing but tunes. Is that true?
That is exactly true. It's a 500 gig hard drive, and I haven't filled it up yet because I haven't committed myself yet to that. From those things, I went off and did my master's in English and film studies, and currently work by day as a corporate drone proofreading flyers, just dealing with the hangover of PhD applications.
You're more of a badass than I ever knew. That's awesome.
I don't recommend any of that stuff, believe me. That broke me in so many fundamental ways that it's not advisable for anything.
It got you here, though. It got you here. Well, let's go down just south of me, actually. Gordon Highland, what's going on with you?
Hey, what's going on? Yeah, I live about 15 minutes from Caleb. My username on the Velvet is Flash. Like a whole lot of people, I started lurking there at the Velvet after the cult, ChuckPalahniuk.net, started pimping Craig Clevenger's The Contortionist Handbook. And I fell in love with that book, came over to the Velvet, lurked for a while, and then I signed up to become a member in January 06. So I've been there for a long time. And then in 08, I became a moderator there, just kind of policing things and marshaling posts around and banning Russian
spam bots,
drones. Yeah, spam bots. And then recently been doing
Those are all just me, right? Like, I just have an awful lot of penis enlargement medication, and you're ruining my business, by the way.
It was a bad eBay buy where you just got a bulk of penis enlargement product and you've got to get rid of it. Well,
I was really, really drunk. The Canadian beer up here is real strong, and
yes.
Do not let a man on Moosehead near eBay.
Who knew that you owned the .ru domain?
I did. All of it.
Yeah, I'm basically, my life is I'm kind of known as a Renaissance kind of guy. I'm a musician, and I write and do design and arty kinds of things. And in my career, I direct and produce and edit videos for a huge corporation.
That's sexy. That is sexy.
Yeah, I was looking at your site, and you're a damn hydra. You got everything. I can barely function, and all I do is sometimes write.
It's like that jack of all trades, master of none. Yeah, Jotman, as we call it.
Come on, there. You're a master of a couple.
Yeah, a couple domains.
You are the author of one of my favorite sigs on the Velvet, which is watch this hawk hawk some hawks at hawk, buck hawk.
Wow, well done.
I ran out of air. I have that thing memorized. I don't even have this, like, all my talking notes.
It's pretty cool when you've achieved a level of Velvet celebrity when people start quoting you in their sig lines.
That's awesome.
Excellent, yes. Begin the thawing of gym neighbors. And Caleb J. Ross.
I was going to pass it up to myself here, but I didn't want to be that guy, but I definitely will be. I came to the Velvet a couple of years ago. In 2006, I was at an AWP conference in Austin. and I happened by a book fair table from the University of Nebraska Press, I believe it is, with Stephen Graham Jones, just kind of sitting, hanging out, looking really lonely and pitiful. And I kind of felt like I should talk to him, but at the same time, I was a little nervous because he was at that time just a huge, and still is, just a great author, huge influence on me. So I walked up to him, introduced myself, and I told him that I was a member of the Velvet. He was much more interested in that than I thought he would be, so I had to make up a bunch of lies for the next 10 minutes during our conversation, saying who I was on the Velvet, who my name was, all of this kind of stuff, which did not exist at that time. I ended up going with him to his next panel, which was with Craig Clevenger.
You followed him to his car.
That's I kind of felt like a weird little guy doing that. Like I was making up this whole backstory that didn't exist just so I could get close to them. But
when he wasn't looking, did you smell his hair?
but what was really embarrassing is Clevenger asked me when I was talking to him a little bit, he asked me who I was in the Velvet, and I had to say, well, a thirsty gerbil, for no reason at all. I just said that word. And he, of course, did not recognize that name because it didn't exist. He asked me, you know, how I made it to this panel, and I said, oh, Will told me about the panel. Of course, I meant Stephen. Will Christopher Bear would be the Will that I was referring to there. I guess it was the three-name thing that mixed me up. Stephen Graham Jones, Will Christopher Bear. But I was,
Craig needs to get he just needs to start using his middle name.
Did you feel like the John Dolan Vincent guy character from the Contortionist Handbook while introducing yourself to Craig Clevenger?
I should sue.
You had a backstory made up and doing sleight of hand tricks with your superfluous pinky.
God, but yeah, but I ended up finding a computer at the conference in some motel lobby. I found a computer and set up an account. And I think if you go to the boards and you look at my first post, it talks. It's pretty much me complaining to the admins about why was my previous account deleted. I don't understand what's going on.
He's never ever going to hear this, but I have to give big ups to Luke Tierney, who is a dude on the Dog Fashion Disco message board, who is talking about Kiss Me Judas. And I finally kind of tracked it down and found out that they were releasing Hell's Half Acre and signed up for the street team. But I hadn't signed up for the Velvet. I actually like hung around and lurked for a solid 2 months, even though I was on the street team and handing out books wherever I went because I wasn't sure about this site. Like the loonies that were showing up and talking about how their accounts were being deleted.
Well, yeah, let's talk a little bit about the Velvet. It was obviously originally created as a discussion board for the works of Craig Clevenger, Will Christopher Bear, and Stephen Graham Jones, who we just mentioned. But it's since grown over the years into a community of writers and readers who are passionate about a variety of topics, from visual art to music to movies and, of course, books. And all of those things are organically connected by their visceral themes and darker tones. We don't have a mission statement. I don't think we need one. If you should be on the Velvet, you'll find your way there.
Well said.
Yeah, the origin of the title, The Velvet itself, is something that I've always loved. And it comes from, for those who don't know, it comes from Will Christopher Bear's Phineas Poe trilogy.
I think it's actually Hell's Half is where it comes out of.
Was it that late?
Yeah. He goes on and on about Jude's vagina for a while.
Yeah. I love the utilitarian, you know, it's a metaphor. It's a euphemism for, you know, it's his girlfriend's vagina who's stealing his kidney. It has a very womb-like, you know, insular feel. The tagline that we often use is "The Velvet warms and binds."
Yeah, every time I log in, I feel like I'm crawling back into the womb.
You spend 9 months trying to get out, and the rest of your life trying to get back in.
On that note, let's go on to our topic at hand. And if I know Gordon as well as I think I do, there will probably be a very cool musical transition right about now.
Today's topic.
That was beautiful. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
We want to talk about communities in general, writing communities, reading communities, because that's at the heart what the Velvet is. What is it that makes them tick? What are they? Why are they or aren't they important? What makes them work and what makes them suck? And you can bring this into the Velvet specifically, but what is it that makes a writing community something attractive to people who do write? The three of us are writers. Not everyone on the Velvet is a writer, I'd say.
Yeah, I looked at it more as like writing communities attached to an author, mostly because I don't like writers. Like for my talking notes, I have the word writer like capitalized and in quotes. And I'm talking about like a specific douchebag who just lugs Joyce around and doesn't actually read it, but just lugs it around to be seen with it. And there's like a very apt signature on the Velvet, but it's something like, you know, you write or you don't. Like, don't talk about writing, just write.
Writers write.
And they don't glamorize it, they don't romanticize it, they fucking do it, and that's about it. That said, when you get those guys who just go in there and they like bluster on about how awesome their novel is and they're just like talking it up, but they're not actually talking to you, that's where I seriously draw the lines. That's why I lurked for 2 months before I even joined the Velvet. You know, they're great for the author to build and connect with their fan base, and for those fans to hear about similar authors, you know, like-minded people who are into the same thing. Also a place where younger writers can prey upon potential fans by saying, I write like blankety blank, and roughly have a captive audience for their spamming.
I think that idea of passion is important because I assume that's probably what you saw with, and that's why you ultimately ended up wanting to join, is because you saw that these were people who, you know, were passionate and they wrote because you said they had to.
The guys that were there at the ground floor, like Logan and Top Bunk Noose and a few of the other guys, that they're not really around nowadays. But what they did to make this work, in my eyes, like, because I have looked at other writing communities and in many cases just like backed right off because it would just anger me and I would just get frustrated and like annoyed at people who were not, they would either, like, if you were submitting a work to kind of get some feedback on it, it would be kind of wishy-washy and they'd be like, I don't know why this character is doing this, and they want it to be spelled out for them. And I'm more looking for like very granular, like word by word, you know, why did you choose this word for this sentence when this one would function better, and like a lot like stronger critique that wasn't there in a lot of those communities. And I think, with those guys who first established it and before we even had any moderators, they had a really strong guiding hand in that.
When I first became a breather, I went back and read a lot of those formative organizational posts about how to lay out the forums and what people will be interested in, and hey, let's not use that technique, let's make this type of sub forum. And
how important do you think it is that that there are mods in the background making sure things people are on topic and staying on top of things? There's a lot of forums out there that are really just self-governing.
You know, I think in our particular case, I think for the most part we do self-govern and it's great. I can't remember a time when I had to come in and lay the verbal bitch slap on somebody to tell them to calm down. I mean, maybe once or twice a year. And even at that, it's very friendly because people at the Velvet, probably because of our commonalities and, you know, that the tangential interests that we all have, we're very respectful. Sometimes someone's just in a pissy mood and you just back off a little bit and the next day they're
fine. It also helps that there's three main guys there. It's not like we're with like Chuck's site. You've got just one guy, and not only that, like someone's made a movie out of one of his books, so he's got this huge, massive influx. It's like a pissing contest to see who got into his stuff first. You know, I was in one of his writing workshops, and I read, you know, one of this story that became a chapter in Survivor, and like, there's a lot of dick waving over at the cult, and I know, not to besmirch it, I mean, that place, I've only poked my head in there once or twice, and that was about it. Because, I mean, obviously, without the cult, Will Christopher Bear and Craig Clevenger and Stephen Graham Jones wouldn't have the following that they do. Like, they were pretty integral. And I'm not talking trash on it. I'm just saying it's really, really interesting that we have this dynamic of three very different writers, but, like, very similar in terms of, like, maybe theme or whatever. But their writing styles are drastically different if you really take it down to, like, a very granular point.
Yeah, I love how you were able to use the word besmirk and dick waving in the same sentence. And that speaks to the diversity of said Velvet right there.
The cult has morphed into a kind of a general topics discussion board. So I think that's just likely that you're going to get a lot more people who are just tangentially interested in those topics. There's a lot of what I like to call "yeah, me too" posts over there, where it's just someone who likes to see their words on the screen and posted. So it's just a lot of people who are like that, but from what I've heard is that their actual writing portions are fairly good. It's just unfortunate that I think it costs money to be a part of it.
Yeah,
I want to extrapolate the whole dick waving thing into just to me. I can use extrapolate and dick in the same sense. I want to put
just,
that.
Just do it on your own time. You know, we don't want to see you extrapolating all over the place.
And I think that is what can bring down a community pretty fast when you get a lot of people who are just there to say what they want to say. You know, I wonder if if that whole dick waving thing has to do with the fact that, you know, we're all writers, and as writers, we kind of, I feel, understand how unimportant our hobby and our craft can be at times. So a lot of times it's really some self-facilitating endeavor. We have, you know, writers for the most part are the people who read. Readers are the people who write. And it's this incestuous group that I think when you get so many people fighting over the same thing, they want to have dominance over something. They want to say, you know, I'm on a higher pedestal than you are in this community. The Velvet doesn't have that. You know, we're very, I think there's a lot of camaraderie going on.
I think one of the main differences there is, and I do still love the cult. I stick to a handful of threads that are focused on reading and writing and books and movies and stuff. And I stay away from the social networking aspects of it. But one difference is Chuck Palahniuk is famous. He's a literary god, you know, and we have to, on the Velvet, we have to advocate on behalf of our authors. And that's something that brings us together. Sort of that street teaming that Rob was talking about earlier, you know, buying a bunch of copies and giving them out. We spend our own time and money on things that their publishers can't, and we just try to promote reading in general. And I think there's sort of a teaming bondage
yeah, bondage
that happens as a result of that. You know, we're sort of pulling for the little guy and trying to get our authors on the shelves and get them the attention that we think they deserve.
Writers are basically slightly self-absorbed, attention-craving assholes. And being a self-absorbed, attention-craving asshole myself, like I understand that all too well, and I try to stay back from it. But I mean, I will be the first one to admit that, you know, if I'm out in public and I'm bored, I will just start making random shit up just because I'm bored. I'm like the conversation, I don't care about who won Survivor or something like that.
When they use the forum as more of a networking platform,
yeah, exactly. They're using it as like a means to just market a captive audience.
Mm-hmm. Let me take this opportunity here to direct all of our listeners to the Charactered Pieces official forum at welcometothevelvet.com. I'm there every day. Drop me a line, and I would love to have dinner with you.
Douchebag.
I don't have it. All I have is like, you guys can go to dreampeople.org. That's all one word, and I have two microcrits. One is about Goatsy, and then I've also got a short story that doesn't make any goddamn sense posted up at Nefarious Muse.
At least on the Howard Stern show, they wait until the end when the virtual credits are rolling for everyone to drop out their plugs. One thing I love about the Velvet and having those common tastes, that those things transcend just books. It transcends all the different types of media. I mean, you guys on the Velvet are my tastemakers. You guys are where I get my recommendations. If you go in my living room and look at my bookshelves, they're 80% composed of things straight out of the "What Are You Reading Now?" thread. I love that. I trust you guys' taste, and that's not something that I can find anyplace else.
I own a copy of Hog by Samuel Delaney, and I'm dragging my ass through that book because of the most disturbing book you've read thread. It's a lot of sex. That's about it.
Mm. Well, it is called Hog, Rob.
Pardon? You thought it was going to be about bacon.
Yeah.
That'd be all right. You can combine the two. You know?
Especially if it's in the most disturbing book you've ever read thread. If it's about bacon, then I'm actually pretty interested in that. Why do you think more publishers haven't built forums? You know, we were just talking about how much of a vocal proponent we are for the three main authors.
I think most publishers don't necessarily have a stable of authors who are similar enough to warrant the kind of communities that would come together to read their other books. Like, that's why I don't frequent a lot of publishers' blogs and whatnot, because I just care about individual books and authors within their stable. But you get some, you know, more of the specialized smaller presses that they have similar, a certain kind of taste that they attract a certain type of writer. And then I could be into, but it's like record labels, you know, an indie label. Rob can speak to this a lot more than I can. There are certain small labels that you'll just listen to anything that they put out, but you're not going to necessarily listen to anything that Atlantic or Geffen puts out.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'll go and hang out on the Rotten Records music board because I've been hanging out there since I was like in first year. Yeah, it doesn't make sense to go to like Atlantic's message board or the Virgin Music, or EMI, I guess is what it is now. The EMI music message board, because it'd be so much disparity between the groups. It would just be madness.
That seems like that would be a whole other topic too that I'd love to maybe explore in a future episode. The idea that small presses should model themselves more like independent record labels, creating fan bases for the press, not necessarily just for the authors themselves. I don't know why more don't do it. I think there's
Raw Dog Screaming does that.
Yeah, exactly.
There's like with all the Bizarro stuff. I mean, you can question a lot of the quality, as I do a lot, because every now and then I'll read it. But then you'll have like you know, someone like D. Harlan Wilson, who okay, he doesn't always put out awesome stuff, but he intermittently puts out some brilliant stuff. Like Peckinpah would probably fit in right with the Velvet people. Bizarro Central stuff with Carlton Mellick III and all those, that's about as close to an indie label as you're going to get, where there's just a lot of like-minded guys.
That's a perfect example. I agree 100%. There's a lot of other presses, like and a lot of other presses that are closely intertwined with websites. HTML Giant, for example, they have a certain, even though all of their authors are on different presses, it's kind of like the Velvet in that sense. It's a blog, but it has a following that is, you know, a few of their authors have gotten pretty big book deals because of the network that they're able to tap into. So,
did you want to talk about writing communities as they relate to writers themselves a little bit? I was going to say that there are also writing communities like Write Club, where people go to workshop their own writings.
I was wondering how important it is for a writing community to have that critique aspect, because it's essentially a group of writers who cage themselves within a password-protected form for a year to put out a novel. They use an entire year to put out a novel, and over the year you are critiqued and you read four other authors, and that's it. So it's, you know, a group of five people intimately involved with their own work and the work of those other people. It's an amazing experience. Gordon, you've been part of it for a couple of years. This is your second year. How is it working for you? What do you think about it?
It's like a safe haven. You know, one where you can kind of, you know, pilot out your own work and run it up the flagpole and see who salutes it. And plus it's password protected and there's not that risk of prior publication and all that stuff. But I can say things there that I wouldn't say on any other forum, partially because it's protected. And it's also just that I know it's not going to leave those walls. And on top of that, and, you know, our tastes aren't always the same. There's the Write Club tastes are a little more all over the map, but you get to know the people in your group. You know, you bond, and they give you, hopefully they give you unflinchingly honest critiques above all. I mean,
and that's what's great about it is, you know, that if someone's going to dedicate an entire year to something, they are serious about writing. They're not just some people passing through, throwing up a few stories and leaving. They're serious about it. And with that seriousness, there comes an understanding that if your work is terrible, they're going to tell you that. They're going to be upfront with you and say this is not working, and you are expected to do the same. Writers who can't take that sort of criticism are going to get, you know, pushed out the door at the very beginning, and I think that's important, honestly. You know, the more people who write, the more it dilutes the status of the capital W writer, the you know, the literature writer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm still a proponent for the editorial gatekeeper. I really do think that it's important for someone with the knowledge to do so, to sort of weed out stuff that is just going to kind of dilute everything and make the entire pool of writing become something of a farce and not something that should be respected intellectually.
I think that's exactly right. No one's ever, you know, when Write Club opens up, you know, we've got a month to get ourselves organized and set our projects up and sort of outline our plans for the year. And then once those doors close, you're kind of locked in, and people do drop out. Hopefully they drop out early. That's something that's always hard to come by in any type of workshopping thing or any type of group activities. I always find the commitment level, no one is ever as passionate about your own project as you are. And in Write Club, you almost get that. I mean, people really care. And I hate to just say Write Club. There are probably other forums out there.
Why haven't you been on Write Club, Rob?
Hmm? Well, again, emphasizing that I don't really like a lot of writers. There's one guy I give a ride to work in the morning who will probably wind up listening to this, and I run that kid through the ringer pretty much every day, and we've written together, and like we have this kind of odd relationship where I tend to try to ruin his life, and he good-naturedly tries to retain his optimism. And
so you're married? Cases,
yeah, we pretty much are. We wrote a couple chapbooks together a while ago. We go back and forth on writing, but we have extreme, like very divergent views on how writing should work and the importance of writing and all that other stuff, but I respect his abilities and stuff like that. So that he's been my sounding board for stuff every now and then.
You guys trust each other's sensibilities and writerly opinions and all, but do you feel that, would you be comfortable given what you know about writing and then incorporating his feedback to send something out at that point, or would you feel like maybe getting one more level of critique might be valuable?
I do trust his feedback to a certain degree. I'm also relentless in revising. My girlfriend will tell you, like, when I was writing papers for school, I would get a first draft ready like maybe 3 weeks in advance, and I was probably on my fifth or sixth draft by the time I was submitting it, and it still probably didn't make an awful lot of sense because I hadn't slept in 5 days. So, and committing to stuff like that, like I've tried to do NaNoWriMo a couple times, and that hasn't worked. That hasn't panned out.
That's National Novel Writing Month for those.
It happens every November. You write a novel from between November 1st and the end of November. But yeah, when I do, like I have heard about Write Club kind of talked up on the forums. I have been hesitant mostly because I have been in that workshop atmosphere before. I took a writer's craft class at the university while I was doing other courses, and I again was like the intense asshole in the room, and then I would get like people kind of coming back like, I like this character, or one response was, ew, sex. One of my stories, I was like, I read that, and I just put that aside, and I was like, I am not reading the rest of your comments. I have lost interest.
That brings up a good thing to talk about, I guess, is the similarities, I guess, between that university level writing workshop and the online critiquing writing workshop forum. Like, you know, I've been a part of both, and the university level definitely has its place. You get a lot of people there who are obviously serious about writing because they're paying to be there. That's a big point. But then you also, at the same time, you don't really know who you're getting into the group with. It could be people who write memoirs, people who've only ever written diary entries, people who write genre fiction. It's just such a mess of styles that often, I think a lot of times, the style preferences get in the way of the actual criticism as far as sentence structure and arc and narrative and that sort of thing.
If it was, you know, someone was writing a historical medieval sci-fi memoir of their grandfather, I mean, I just could not give less fuck.
If that was a memoir, though, and it was sci-fi, historical, and all that other stuff you said, that would be pretty amazing.
That sounds like something Stephen Graham Jones has just written.
Yeah, he's just written in that breath.
He's writing it now as we're talking about it.
He's going to have the editorial pass done before we hang up this call. Yeah.
There's something to be said, though, for similarities, because what I realized is it forced me to focus on what truly is similar about storytelling. Storytelling at its heart, there's an arc, there's a climax, there's denouement, there's, you know, that whole Aristotle arc. It's that sort of thing that maintains really no matter what style or genre you're looking at. And I think it depends on the professor too. The professor is essentially the moderator of the critique group, and if the professor can kind of hammer things down and really explain to people before you even get to the workshopping stage what a story is and what makes a story work, and people are able to learn from it, then hopefully you've got some good stories to critique. If you don't have some good stories to critique, those chances are those are people who aren't going to learn anyway. You know, if they refuse to learn, they're not going to learn. So really,
it's good to have that like that layman response. Like, okay, just some bumpkin on the street is picking up my book off a shelf, and you know their response is, "It was sex." Okay, well, fine. You're maybe not my target audience.
But, exactly, and you can kind of get rid of
them. You're also just getting the knee jerk feedback from people that aren't, you know, they aren't your friends. They aren't, you know, like the first thing I've internalized is like, if anybody has anything good to say about my work, they're lying. and it's just because like I know I can see all of the warts, and that's all I'm seeing.
That's a good way to look at it, though. I mean, if someone's only complimentary and you know them even a little bit, you really can't trust what they're saying unless you're in a close group like Write Club or The Velvet, where you know these people are going to tell you truth. If it's terrible, it's terrible. So
I always just find like I start off and I say, hey, this was great and I'm glad you're doing this, even if it's not really that great, just something that can – some people need some encouragement to keep going now and then. And then I hit them, you know, with all the stuff that sucks.
Yeah, I gave Chris Deal some feedback on one of his stories. That's Enjoy on the forums. And I was going like sentence by sentence and word by word. And I almost felt bad when I looked at all the comments. And then I like – after I'd read it, I was like, this is still a really good story. Like this guy, it's obvious he has the chops. And it's just, you know, there's a few things that like he may want to try to iron out. And it was mostly just suggestions. I think he actually wound up submitting that somewhere. I can't remember offhand.
I'm sure if it's Enjoy, he did submit it.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's somewhere right now. He has he's rivaling Stephen Graham Jones for prolificity. So,
yeah, that guy's crank. Every time I look in the whoring thread, he's cranking something else at him. Like, man, I have to celebrate is I published a short essay on Goatsy that was relentlessly cut down. It still doesn't make any goddamn sense.
Does Goatsy make any sense though? I mean, really? I guess I should probably read your essay.
I was trying to troll for an argument of like that as being the highest form of art that we humans will create. When they were talking about the internet, and they were talking about it as, you know, this is going to connect everybody and everybody's going to be so much smarter as a result. No, you're going to get some guy stretching his asshole out. And that's and you're going to get lolcats.
And 4chan and two girls, yeah. One cup. And
that is the highest aspirations the human race.
What about two girls, two cups? Huh?
Right.
What do you guys think?
It's one better now, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Mount Olympus.
Let's look at the Mount Olympus Forum at the Velvet. The Mount Olympus Forum is a place where the really important threads go, the threads that have a lot of conversation and a lot of discussion about them. So
you had this really meaty debate that was going on. We ran the gamut. We went from commenting on the publishing industry to wrestling bears to anecdotes about being passionate about books. And like, it was a great story in there from, I think, Van Damage, who was talking about, you know, some guy coming up to him like, what you reading for? And like, you a sissy? And like, he was just like, yep, yep, yep.
Yeah.
And his final retort was something to the effect of like, you know, while you're off work construction, I'm going to go home and get with your old lady. And the guy's like, hey, you ass. Wait, what's that book about?
Yep. What you reading for? Because I can.
Yeah, what you, and that always brought me back to Bill Hicks, who was sitting in a, he was telling a story about, like, he was a comedian, and he was talking about reading in a diner in some southern U.S. town, and this woman walked up to him and said, what you reading for? And he didn't know how to answer the question. He's like, well, I guess I'm reading so that I don't have to, you know, work the rest of my life in a diner.
So I can learn, yeah, not to end my sentences in prepositions.
Mount Olympus, yeah, to me, it's like, I love Mount Olympus. That's where I send newbies, like, when they're thinking about signing up or whatever, because it's like, yeah, the litmus test for them. It's sort of like the Velvet greatest hits. You know, if we were to...
Well, yeah, basically, yeah, that what I was, yeah, what I was thinking what, in terms of that, the way I always kind of figured it was, it kind of preserves the feel of the board that, like, it kind of shows that, you know, everyone's kind of pretty good-natured, and it shows the better discussions we've had on the board. And it may be alienating to a few people who are like, you know, they're used to just going on a board and trolling people and calling people faggots. And then they'll realize that this is not, like, they're just going to be weirded out by all of this, mm-hmm, you know, being nice to each other. And they might hang out for a day or two and, you know, act like a jerk off, but they're going to be gone real quick.
Yeah.
I think that'll probably be one of the times where we will just drop the ban hammer real fast and that's it.
And that's mostly, it's of their own hand. They just, you know, kind of pick up.
Yeah, they just go away.
And they realize that people are pretty literate. You know, a friend of mine is very fond of saying, never enter a battle of wits half armed.
But yeah, I think what it is it kind of, it's almost like a legacy for people that are coming on the board. Like, not everybody sticks around. Like, you know, Puka will disappear and other users will just pop in and out. I mean, I'll go on, you know, 6 month tears where I'm just not there. And it's for whatever reason. I'm, you know, buried under books. Like, as it stands, my room looks like I've been living like a psychopath for the past 3 years. There's like books everywhere. And
that's an awesome image of you being buried under books and no one had heard from you for 6 months.
That's the way I want to go out.
The Mount Olympus Forum, kind of wanted to focus on one specifically called Dudes Don't Read, which I think it was prompted by an article.
From the Huffington Post, yes.
What that article talks about is that the market for male fiction or fiction for male readers is very, very, very slim. And it kind of goes into, well, just the reasons behind that. You know, so much writing is geared towards women, especially women over 50, I think it says, is the target market. And at the Velvet, where I would say mostly the reading material is male oriented and probably more willing to ring true with males. The
it's a sexual thing, really.
It is. It's a sexual thing, and that's what I want it to be. What do you guys think about that? There was a lot of heat from the members of the Velvet, specifically, I think, because they are mostly male, saying that's not true. Whereas this author, I think...
What he'd said, his argument was more to the effect of, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in that the publishers are sitting there saying, okay, most women, like, we've done studies, most women are buying... Are the book buyers of the family. And I'll be the first one to say, like, my girlfriend is more well-read than I am. She has her degree in architectural science and a whole lot more useful than I am. And, like, I was doing a Canadian lit class, and I really loved this class, and she still read more of the books than I did.
Canadians don't write. Canadian lit?
You know what? I didn't think so, but I got to plug one dude, Fred Waugh. He's a poet.
Is he Ben's brother, or like W-A-H?
W-A-H, yeah. But not Benoit. Okay. No, Benoit. That's a bit intense. I knew a girl who showed me one of her Benoit balls, and she's like, guess where the other one is? Anyways, she was not related to him. Yeah, he wrote Waiting for Saskatchewan. And if you are at all unsure about decent poetry, pick that book up because it's pretty solid. Yeah, he like kind of goes on about sort of inheritance from like what you inherit from your father, you know, metaphorically speaking. And it's almost like a journal, but he kind of goes off on like some other references to like literal genes. And he almost borders on like biopunk, which is sort of a takeoff from obviously cyberpunk. Anyways.
And he's Canadian and he's a man and he has readership.
Well, he has the problem with Canadian writing is that it's all academics. Like Margaret Atwood makes her bread and butter on the fact that, you know, The Handmaid's Tale is taught in almost every English 101 class. And I think that's kind of a shortfall because a lot of academics don't know how to write.
Yeah, and actually down here on the South Side, if you listen to Neil Young, it actually counts as community service credit. Neil Young's Canadian.
Yes, he is. I love how Chrome, I think, posted on the board after the Olympics. He's like, I didn't even realize Neil Young was Canadian.
They should have, you know, like they have the Jew, not a Jew game. They should have Canadian, not a Canadian, because I think a lot of people will get tripped up on that.
that was dead.
Anyways, so I think what the guy's main argument was that the perception is that men don't read and that the marketing that comes out of the publishers nowadays, because I actually did reread the article and stuff like that and kind of follow a bit of the argument on the thread. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy. This guy was saying that, yeah, guys probably would read if, you know, the publishers gave them a chance. And mm-hmm. they don't really, like, they don't pass, you know, the subway test where, you know, he showed a cover of a book that probably would connect with a lot of guys, but it had, like, a big flower on the front of it.
Look at what sells. A lot of self-help stuff, a lot of nonfiction, and men do not want help. I mean, it's a sign of weakness and the, you know, all these relationship guides and stuff, and we really don't want to read those things. I think, you know, women, you look at book clubs, that they those things, granted, I'm sure they're a minority, but they propagate sales. Majority of book clubs are women.
Lit bitches who read.
Yeah, lit bitches. We have a contingent of a few bitches, lit bitches on the Velvet. So
self-proclaimed, I think it's important that we say they
coin that. Interweb fist bump for the lit bitches what read.
There we go.
Yeah. And the women, I mean, this is going out of limb here, but I think they have longer attention spans and stuff. You know, they are more apt to want to sit down and put themselves, invest in themselves emotionally in something than a man who just wants to get in and out in 5 minutes, you know, so to speak.
And they are smarter than us.
Yeah.
True. Yeah. Where do you think it started, though? Do you think it started, like, you said it was
a chicken egg thing?
Yeah, exactly. Where do you think it started?
Well, you know, I think the article has it right in that, you know, some of the thing is that with agents and marketing, and there's something that is so frustrating that I hear agents say, or marketing departments for publishers, is, I don't know how to sell this. That is your fucking job. You know, if I could say that,
yeah,
when I showed up for work in the morning, I would be fired. Figure out a way to market it and get it in front of the right people.
So it's their responsibility then to create the market as opposed to just riding the trends that are already out there?
At this point, I don't know where it started, but I think in order to right the ship, that has to happen from here.
Gotcha. Do you think it's laziness? What do you think it is? Like, do they rely on these Twilight sort of things where, you know, one book makes it big, so then...
That's a tent pole, right? You know?
Yeah.
I got you. I think they kind of always have done that, though. I think what you're looking at is almost a symptom of a lot of industries that they don't know how to deal with what, like, the major cultural shifts that have happened post 2000, basically. We've become so inundated with visual style and, you know, DVDs and video games and everything else that reading has kind of taken a bit of a backseat. And a lot of these publishers and, like, you know, same thing with the music companies too. They're really slow to react to this kind of stuff. As the internet has progressed, it's just gotten easier and easier and easier to pirate everything. It's more of a cultural thing for the publishers. They just don't know how to react to this sudden influx of stuff. And I mean, people are still reading and people are still looking for that kind of outlet, and they're just trying to find some way to capture that. And in the meantime, they're just falling back on their old strategies of, okay, well, this is hot right now. Let's just push a bunch of shit out the door and make a quick buck and keep going for next fiscal year and hope something happens.
I hate to go back and you know, kiss Polonick's minimalist ass again, but just like with Fight Club, the movie didn't do very good in the theaters. It was a bomb. I don't know if it was a bomb, but it wasn't successful. Then it came out on, you know, on video, and it had a great cult following and all that. And then the book, that was my, like most people on the Velvet, but probably half the people on the Velvet, he was my gateway book back into reading fiction again, because during that whole time, I was always a voracious reader, but it was nonfiction. I was reading media stuff and, you know, film and music and screenwriting and all that stuff. And now, you know, he got me back into that, saying, you know, this is a masculine, I didn't need it to be masculine necessarily, but it could compete with the mass media stuff, with the video games and all that, just the viscerality, if that's a word, of it. And
there's an immediacy to his writing that just it hits you over the head, and you're like, okay, you know, this is about as cool as playing a video game. I took a class. It was Novel in the Age of Cinema. This was like for my master's, and at the very beginning of the class, the prof was showing us Jane Austen, and I think like just basically a wide range of authors, and basically just kind of he was roughly charting the development of like film media and stuff like that, and he was pointing to cues in the text that were like basically like the text mimicking filmic techniques, and it was just sort of showing the flexibility of the novel and that it can adapt to new media forms. And I think that's what we're starting to see with, like, you know, Mark Z. Danielewski putting out
with you going with Z for the Z, though, that's righteous.
It's and then putting out House of Leaves, and like again just cropping through that, that was an astonishing experience for me just to go through that, and my mind was blown, because he was imitating not only essays but filmic techniques and mm-hmm. almost a forum where there was this weird back and forth between people, and
you could teach an entire class on House of Leaves.
It had its visual, a lot of visuality to it that was just incredible, and I think more stuff like that is probably going to come down the pipe. And I know people charge them with being gimmicky and whatever, but I think that's kind of what you need now, at least to a certain degree. I mean, the content will follow, and there's a lot of depth to that story too. Okay, fine, he's borrowing really heavily from Borges, and he's borrowing really heavily from Nabokov, and he's borrowing really heavily from all these other guys, but that's not new. That's always happened.
No, there's nothing new under the sun, right? What do you think about all this, Caleb?
Oh, my fear with all of that is that I think publishers will think that the next logical step is, instead of mimicking filmic techniques, is to literally replicate filmic techniques, especially with like the iPad and these other ebook readers and things coming out that include screens. My fear is that they're going to think of including motion picture as an evolution, when I think that's not necessarily an evolution. It's maybe carving out a different demographic or a different market, but I would not want it to, and I wouldn't call it the evolution of reading. I think most people want a standalone book. They want the text. They want to be immersed in that. And I'm afraid that people will buy these new things when they come out. They'll buy these new things, and publishers and industry people will mistake that for abandoning books and taking on this new media.
Do you see the multimedia experience and literature being mutually exclusive?
Yeah, I do. I think the novel and multimedia are exclusive. I think they can overlap in some sense, but it's not going to become, if it overlaps, it's no longer a novel. You know, just like if you add Jack to Coke, it's no longer Coke. It's a Jack and Coke now. So, and I think that's what's going to happen. And like I said, I don't want the industry to think that that's actually moving forward and moving in a direction so that they abandon writing completely. They abandon books completely.
I'm probably under the impression that the industry doesn't give two shits about what the novel is. They just care that it sells.
That's very true.
I love Reese's peanut butter cups. I love chocolate. I love peanut butter. Bam, you know. But I still love chocolate and peanut butter individually, but I can learn to embrace a peanut butter cup.
Yeah, yep. You can.
Well, and you're also getting stuff like, you know, for the iPhone, the Twitlet stuff where
that
people
sounds
are
dirty.
I know.
Sounds like something you put up against your hoo-ha and switch it to vibrate, you know?
I know. Oh, man. Twatlet. Anyways.
Well, that would be L-E-T. Yeah.
Oh, that's a disturbing mental image.
You hear this clicking? You hear this clicking? That's the sound of me going on to the next topic. Do we have another topic?
Other voices, other rooms.
Yeah, let's go on to what are you reading? What are you guys imbibing right now? Whether it's reading, watching movies, what are you doing right now? Or if you're not reading anything right now, what's something you've read recently that you just really, really want to tell everyone about?
I'm sure he won't mind me talking about it, even though it's in progress, so to speak. I'm reading Angel Falls by Michael Paul Gonzalez, otherwise known as Monkey Wright. Well, it's like, you know, the book, it's still, you know, I don't know, he might do another revision pass on it or something, but he's going to be sending it out, and it's really good. It reminds me a lot of, if you like Christopher Moore, I hope he would like me saying this, it is Christopher Moore through and through. It's got kind of the classic good and evil and God and devil archetypes and sort through a satirical lens, and it's a lot of fun, and I'm really enjoying it.
Awesome.
I missed his call. He posted a call to send it out to people, and I missed that, unfortunately. But awesome, awesome. What about you, Rob? What are you up to?
I am very heavily not analyzing very much of what I'm doing, but I finally got around to get back to Inherent Vice by Thomas Pynchon.
Nice. How's that going?
It's going really well, and it's it goes to remind me that Pynchon is not writing a new grave, will not be writing another Gravity's Rainbow, and that makes me very happy. Not that Gravity's Rainbow is a bad book by any means. I really, really enjoyed it, and it's pretty straightforward. It's a kind of a love letter to Chandler. If Chandler and James M. Cain at all ever got along together, it'd be like that mixed with 60s hippieism. But it's funny because every critic I've read about, like, Against the Day and everything that's come out pretty much since Gravity's Rainbow, they're always like, oh, this guy has fallen off and, like, he's not writing to the same quality. And I'm like, you know what, this dude is just writing what he wants to. And the thing is like, him on a bad day is still top-notch stuff. And just the guy has got away with sentences, and I went in expecting to hate him. With a Fiery Passion, I was looking to hate him. I read V, and I was about 100 pages in. I'm like, Jesus Christ, when is this guy going to do something that makes me hate him? And at the end, usually at the end of like a 300-page novel, I can sit there and say, okay, they could have cut out 50 pages of that, and I would have been fine. And at the end of a 500 to 600-page novel, which was V, I looked back on it, and I said, you know, there was one chunk, maybe one chapter he could have kicked out. It was Mondoggin's story, and even then there were a few moments there that kind of kept me interested. It was just, but that guy has a way of writing sentences that just feel really damn important. And I'm reading Imaginative Qualities of Actual Things by Gilbert Sorrentino, and that's just leftover Stockholm Syndrome for my master's, because I had to read Little Casino by him for one of my classes, and I had to read a lot of interviews with him. I wouldn't wish Sorrentino on my worst enemy, but he's got some cool stuff to say about writing, so look up his interviews, because he's an interesting guy. I'm reading Optical Media by Friedrich Kittler. He's a theorist. He's looking at how optical media has altered the way we process information. And he's cool because he's talking about, he's saying, like, if you want to learn how a culture processes information, look at its art, look at its novels, because that's sort of like a demilitarized zone where people are just able to appropriate different types of media. And
that's an awesome expression.
Yeah, different ways, and just kind of just run with it. And he brought up a really cool point in one of his other essays where he mentions that, like, the most used books, like the phone book and the Bible, are more image-based than textual. And that effectively the printing press was made to actually replicate like script handwriting. It was more actually trying to create images more than it was trying to create text. So the people are drawing these lines between image and text, and they're not actually really all that there. And at its core, they were very close to each other. And interestingly, the printing press is actually just a sobered-up wine press, which I thought was kind of funny because, you know, a lot of writers are just alcoholics with writing. Right.
That's awesome. What was that guy's name again?
Friedrich Kittler. If you're going to pick up any of his books, Optical Media is the way to go, because it's pretty straightforward. They give you a summary of some of his thought, and he's a pretty interesting guy. He's got some cool stuff to say.
What are you reading, Caleb?
Thank you. As for me, I am reading Fugue State by Brian Evanson. I'm still trolling through that. Well, trolling is not the right word. I'm loving every second of it. As anyone on the forums might know, I have an obsession with Evanson, probably to an unhealthy degree. But it's you know, it's a great collection. It's probably not quite as great as his previous collection, The Wavering Knife, which is my favorite collection by him. But, you know, it's going really great. I'm about halfway through it. I just finished a story called 90 over 90, which is not typical Evanson. So if you like Evanson, I mean, you'll still love it, but it's not typical Evanson. It's a story that kind of makes me love the fact that I write what I would call literature. It's a story about a character who is an editor for a publishing house, and he's charged with acquiring some stuff that'll sell, essentially. But all he wants to do is publish literature, and it kind of you know, he's being lambasted for just wanting to publish good stuff, but the entire industry is saying, you can't do that. That doesn't make money. You're being stupid. He sticks to his guns, and it just kind of unravels in a weird Evanson-like way. And it's
definitely a fairy tale.
It's and, this is actually called a memoir, which is very strange.
Are there any elves in it?
No.
You lost me. Sorry.
What's strange,
I want some talking trees.
What's strange, though, is I've been reading his stuff for a long, long time, and his earlier stuff would definitely be considered literature, and his first big collection was through Knopf, which is a pretty big house, and everything he's published since then has gotten more and more genre-like, but has gone with smaller and smaller presses. So he's sort of writing about the inverse of how his own career has gone, and it's a great story. The entire collection is fantastic so far.
Think Tank.
The Think Tank is a forum on the Velvet boards in which people bring up their own work and just kind of talk about their own work. I guess it's probably the closest to the critiquing side of the Velvet that we get. So what we want to do is have one of the members here just talk about what they're writing and maybe an issue they're coming across and see if we can't make fun of them for it and have him crying. So let's do that. Rob, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, so Friday I was driving home or driving back to work from my house. I was listening to The Bronx, their new album, The Bronx, which is all of their albums have been titled The Bronx. They're a punk band out of L.A. Entertainingly enough, they also have a mariachi band called Mariachi El Bronx. Anyways, they have a song called Knife Man, which is pretty awesome, actually. It's the first line is, I want to be original, I want to be surrounded by art. But everything is digital, the formula is now falling apart. Anyways, there's another line where he says, this isn't music, it's a pyramid scheme. So I wound up thinking about pyramid schemes for some bizarro reason, and like thinking about it in like very, very dark terms, and looking at, like, I was thinking about H.P. Lovecraft and a bunch of other stuff, and I was thinking about a relationship in which, you know, you have someone who is more powerful than another person and kind of employs them to help them move up in the pyramid, basically. And this is kind of going hardline genre, which is kind of weird because I don't really like writing hardline genre stuff. But just thinking about it as, say, like a guy's rising up through the ranks of some powerful wizards, for lack of a better term, and he's bringing an enforcer with him. He finds like an ex-Marine to kind of just throw in the muscle when he can't send some nameless beast after someone. And that relationship is based on him giving this guy slightly more power to kind of keep him strung along. But he can't give him so much that he's going to overtake him. He can't have the apprentice take over the teacher. And so I was thinking about that, the mechanics of that relationship kind of breaking down. It has a set timeline. Because at a certain point, that guy is just going to start demanding it. And then he'll have to kill him or do something. So I was looking at it along those lines. And then I kind of was, my main problem with any genre fiction is style and narrative voice are always separate from the content. People are throwing around crazy-ass spells, and that doesn't change a damn thing about anybody's perception. What I was looking at it was, is there a way I can look at... I'd always wondered if there was a way to write a second-person story, like a second-person narrative, where you're talking as you, which is, I know, a no-no, because you can't do that. Like, that was brought up in other writers' discussions, and basically it's an invasive thing to do. It upsets the reader. They lose interest because you're telling them something.
It feels like choose your own adventure. You're running down a hall. Boom, wall.
Exactly. And, yeah, or like going back to, you know, my roots in language and like the Zork games. You know, yes. You are standing west of White House with boarded up windows. There is a mailbox right here. Fuck that mailbox. I don't want to open it. But I was kind of interested to see how that would play in terms of, you know, in those situations, there's a lot of pent-up resentment. So what I'm looking at is kind of a flash fiction, and I'm trying to see if it'll fly. It alternates between first and second person, where effectively what this guy has done is cast some sort of spell or whatever, because he wants to experience this guy's death. He wants to experience this guy's fear and pain because he's been screwing him and stringing him along the entire time. So what happens is it wakes up with you are bound and gagged on a floor. Then it cuts to, like, you know, I smear the rest of the blood and semen and the sigil around, like, the guy. I've only written like a couple lines of this, obviously, but
I'm glad you got the blood and semen in there right away.
Of course, the blood and semen is required. I was really pissed. Like, that's another thing I have. I think a lot of that stuff gets dismissed as being escapist genre fiction, especially Lovecraft. And there's a lot of potential there to screw around with some shit. And I don't think people capitalize on it, mostly because they don't care. Like, they just want, okay, let's throw Cthulhu in there.
So So you're trying to take it, most of it's first person and then switch to second, right? So it's I'm doing this.
So switch to second intermittently. You're doing yeah. But I'm just wondering if you guys have had any experience with that stuff that isn't that like would that just come off as hokey or is that coming off as like I guess it just depends on how I handle it, but
you know, if you used it as a device, it's like when it's really obvious that you read you and we know that flips a switch in our brain that okay, you know, if you've established whatever that is immediately. That doesn't really bother me, you know, because it's even though it's a little bit gimmicky, I know to put myself in that headspace and, you know, it's like it sets the expectation for the reader and you keep those and it's a short piece anyway. So you're going to be granted a lot of experimental leeway anyway, hopefully.
Yeah.
But that would not bother me. It just would need to be clear who you is.
Yeah, exactly.
Who you are.
You is.
You are what you is, as Frank Zappa would say.
Yes.
You is what you am. A cow don't make ham.
I think that I think Gordon, you know, he brings up a good point in that being flash fiction, you're allowed to do a lot more. You're allowed to be clever if you want to. Someone's not going to feel like their time is wasted after they get through reading it.
Yeah.
But of course, you know that, and you obviously don't want someone to feel like their time is wasted. So, I mean, there's definitely examples of longer fiction that use the second person perspective. Who is it? Jay McInerney? How do you pronounce it? I don't know.
McInerney. Bright lights, big titties. Yeah.
That one. That's the one. I think that was effective simply because you knew the entire time that you were getting as invested in the character as you would if it was from a different point of view. So as long as you're not trying to use that as a crutch to say, since I'm saying you as the reader all of a sudden need to have a certain level of investment in here. I think as long as you still understand that you have to build the character up, you have to do everything
I fully expect that I'm going to have like the underling who is now kind of surpassing this guy. I fully expect to have him say a line like literally like, I'm pretty sure this is very invasive for you, but oh well, I'm sorry. I don't really care that much. You're a dick.
Are you going to go so far as to italicize those sections?
No.
That's good.
No, my goal is to not have to resort to any more gimmick than I have to. Mm-hmm. So, and I think, yeah, like I think Stephen Graham Jones is always perpetually afraid of overusing italics.
You need a section break though at each, I would think.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There'll be like a line break, a hash, or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've written anything, and that's coming from a lot of reasons. And I'm also working on another short story, which I won't go into detail, but I am going to be submitting it to the Lush Triumphant contest for Subterrane.
Is that a drinking contest?
No, it's not, oddly enough.
Every hashtag, you take a shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, of course. Yeah, no, people were watching they were watching the hockey game,
yeah,
or the American Canadian hockey game for the Olympics, and I was in the next room on my laptop drinking a martini and writing this.
They do a shot every time there's a shot on goal, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I just heard a lot of yelling in the other room, yeah. And I was like, ah, cool, you guys are scaring the cat. So,
meanwhile, there you are with blood spattered all over your walls and like severed heads, drowning in literal
semen everywhere.
Yeah. But they're scaring the cat with their hooping over Canadian hockey.
Assholes.
I'm trying to gracefully find a way to get out of the semen.
That's what Emily said to me a bunch of times. No.
Well, I hope we helped out with your think tank query.
Feel the noise.
Since we have Rob here on the line, mutter some taxicab and his vast musical knowledge that he brings to the Velvet. I was wondering if maybe you could give us your like top five sort of accessible artists that you think, you know, the Velvins could be into sort of in general, because you were always on the cusp of like the cool shit coming out that I never heard of, but some of it's really cool. Maybe not the speed metal so much, but you know.
Oh, no, that's fair. It was interesting that you'd like immediately the accessible stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you guys should definitely download Piss Angel by Pig Destroyer. And when Brand New's new album came out, I listened to that a lot. It's an interesting band because they keep releasing really drastically different stuff with every album. And the newest one is like very heavy on the guitar rock and It's a vicious record, even when they're not being heavy. Like, they've got some good barbs with their lyrics that are just, they're pretty top notch. Matthew, good band. If you were going to download any of that stuff, like, just download Beautiful Midnight by him and make sure it's the Canadian edition with I Miss New Wave on there. At the Drive-In is kind of accessible. They're the dudes before Mars Volta and Sparta.
Right. I don't know. For when you just said that, I thought, did they get back together? Because, you know, after Mars and...
They've been kicking that around a bit, and I don't know if they're really going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I would be astonished if they did.
Right.
Tegan and Sarah, also top-notch female vocalists from Canada. You probably have heard a bit more about them because they've been played on the OC and
sure.
other stuff, but they put on a really, really cool, charming live show, and Sarah Sleen, who is another Canadian songstress.
Spell that last name for us.
Sarah Sleen, S-L-E-A-N, and she does a phenomenal cover of Climbing Up the Walls by Radiohead. And I don't know, Hide Your Daughters, which is a punk band. They're a dirty punk band from Winnipeg, and they've since gone on to do a bunch of other stuff.
In other Feel the Noise news, this afternoon, it suddenly dawned upon me. I was listening to the Sirius FM 80s channel, and it hit me that Caribbean Queen by Billy Ocean is the same song as Billie Jean.
Oh, man.
Yeah, you listen to, like, the bass line. It's got kind of that circular dunk, 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 and the, like, that kind of skanking guitar with the bang, dang, 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 dang. Yeah, they're almost, I mean, not the same song, but not in like a I Want a New Drug / Ghostbusters type of the exact same song. But yeah, that's, man, too soon.
But I can think of other things. The Johnny Cash cover of Rusty Cage.
Yes.
Take that. And, like, just the midpoint where the electric guitar comes in, and compare that to Monster Magnet's Space Lord.
Okay.
The opening guitar riff.
Yeah.
It's not dead on, but it's close enough that whenever we were playing that at the record store I worked at for a while, I could not help myself but, like, bust out screaming Space Lord, Mother, Mother. Aside from that, I've had entirely too much moose head.
You know, the main problem I have with moose head is the antlers dig it into my stomach.
Really? No, you just put it in the nose. Actually, I have a picture of a dude putting a dick in a horse's nose. If you want one, you know.
Well, is that like a tool extra? You in one of Tool's album covers, you peel back the thing, and
every now and then, I against my better judgment, I go to lamgo.com, which I review for them. So when I have time, which I haven't for a while, yeah, I went on their forums, and every now and then this dude. I think his name is Huntfish with Dynamite. If he ever listens to this, oh dear God, you know, my life is over.
You're outing the guy who defiled a horse's nostril.
No, he did not. He just keeps posting this picture of a dude with his wang and a horse's nose.
And it's not him, right? It's probably him.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know if the Google image search would show up if you searched horsedick.jpg.
Quick plug for myself before we get out of here. Major Inversions, my novel. Please buy it through CreateSpace, Amazon. Go to my webpage, gordonhyland.com. Yo.
That's a lovely way to segue into Character Pieces. That is my short story collection from OW Press. Buy it. It's really, really good.
It's really good. And if you don't believe Caleb, just ask Caleb.
I will tell you again. Well, this has been awesome. I love getting together with you guys, talking about this kind of stuff. It's been great. We obviously haven't had any feedback yet because this is the very first episode, but if you guys have feedback, go to welcometothevelvet.com/podcast and you can see all the show notes for the show. You can also leave some comments there, or you can leave comments directly at the appropriate thread at welcometothevelvet.com, which will also be linked in the show notes. If you have any comments at all that you don't want to post and you're too embarrassed to, go ahead and send them to us at comments@thevelvetpodcast.com. On April 9th, Gordon and myself will be reading at the Lila European Cafe in Denver, Colorado, as part of the AWP conference. Head over there. We'll link to the AWP conference and the specific information on that reading in the show notes. So we're really excited about that. It should be a whole lot of fun. We'd love to see you guys there.
Break a leg, guys.
Thanks so much. I hope the two people who are listening to this show up. This has been great. We'll pick it up next time. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. That was awesome.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun.